thank you for coming along to the session today, which, as you can see, is entitled Proto Science Fiction. A bit of background about myself, because I'm probably new to most of you here. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of English and Journalism. Most of the stuff I tend to do is journalism and public relations related, although I do take the Level 3 Science Fiction module for English and also for Film and Television Studies, and often supervise dissertations which have a kind of science fiction theme and so on, as well as feeding into Catherine Redpath's bit after the end module at Level 2. So there you are, that's a bit of background about myself. So what we're going to do today over the next 48, 49 minutes, well, we're going to talk you through really some of the thoughts that kind of emerged within the Edwardian period, within writers, specifically looking at H.G. Wells and others who kind of influenced the whole thing, and really giving you some sort of indication of some of the influences that Wells was faced with, some of the tropes that worked through, with particular relevance to the text War of the Worlds, which we mentioned. And I'll just start off with this from chapter 11 from War of the Worlds. I have already said that my storms of emotion have a trick of exhausting themselves. After a time, I discovered that I was cold and wet, and with little pools of water about me on the spare carpet. I got up almost mechanically, went into the dining room and drank some whiskey, and then I was moved to change my clothes. After I'd done that, I went upstairs to my study, but why I did so, I do not know. The window of my study looks over the trees and the railway towards Horsell Common. In the hurry of our departure, this window had been left open. The passage was dark, and by contrast with the picture the window frame enclosed, the side of the room seemed impenetrably dark. I stopped short in the doorway. The thunderstorm had passed. The towers of the Oriental College and the pine trees about it had gone, and very far away, lit by a vivid red glare, the common about the sandpits was visible. Across the light, huge black shapes, grotesque and strange, moved busily to and fro. It seemed indeed as if the whole country in that direction was on fire, a broad hillside set with minute tongues of flame, swaying and writhing with the gusts of the dying storm and throwing a red reflection upon the cloud scud above. Every now and then, a haze of smoke from some nearer conflagration drove across the window and hid the Martian shapes. I could not see what they were doing, nor the clear form of them, nor recognize the black objects they were busied upon. Neither could I see the nearer fire. Though the reflections of it danced on the wall and ceiling of the study, a sharp, resinous tang of burning was in the air. That's from the opening of chapter 11. And if you weren't familiar with the text, other than the mention of the word Martian, you might think, it's a kind of standard, almost gothic romance scenario from that point of view. Well, yes, because Wells is writing from his own experience and his perspective. H.G. Wells, Herbert George Wells, acclaimed as one of the fathers of modern science fiction. Show him in a few seconds. There he is. He published more than 50 novels during his lifetime, which went from 1866 to 1946. But his reputation as a science fiction writer is based mainly on the success of his earlier works. And in particular, four key works, one of which is War of the Worlds, the other ones being The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Invisible Man. Written within a very productive period just prior to the turn of the century. He was, as I mentioned, born in Bromley, Kent in 1866, and he came from a background where his father was a shopkeeper and his mother was a domestic servant. His education was erratic. He spent 3 years working as a draper's apprentice and a brief spell as a chemist's apprentice, as well as stints as a pupil teacher at two schools before finally winning a scholarship to what was then referred to as the Normal School of Science, which later became the Royal College of Science. So, in keeping with an awful lot of science fiction writers, he's kind of being influenced by, you know, his own experience and thinking about what is happening in science at the time. And if I can take you back slightly, 100 and odd years, a little bit more than that, 120, 130 years, to the sort of 19th century and so on, that's at a period where Britain in particular is at the top of its game. It is by far the world's most dominant power. It's also a time where arguably the first science fiction text had actually been written by Mary Shelley back in the early part of the 19th century with Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. But equally, there are a number of other writers who are exploring this whole notion of science, philosophy, adventures, romantic stories, tales which sort of open up a whole range of sort of key factors. Writers such as Jules Verne, Journey to the Centre of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This whole notion that actually with technology and basically the heart of the Industrial Revolution working, we were seeing a consistent drive to, well, we've already improved in our lifetime considerably. You know, progress is clear, it's tangible, it's evident, you can touch it. You're shifting away from the notion of a religious-based dogma running through the constant society. And really with the science of the time and, of course, the gentleman called Charles Darwin, who with Origins of the Species turned a whole range of thoughts on its head, the suggestion that maybe science was a way to develop these things. Well, Wells is on record as saying that, as well as obviously being influenced by writers such as Verne, Latterly, Burroughs, and so on and so forth, he was quite keen on a number of key concepts. And when we start talking about the concepts that he's likely to be addressing, again, you can block them into key areas. I mentioned that it was 1895 when the time machine first emerged. We are time travellers. You are time travellers. I'm a time traveller. You know, just the very notion of travelling through time in one direction. Why shouldn't you relate to that whole notion of how time changes? And in addition to time changing, remember also at this time you have the beginnings of social justice being sought after. Works of Karl Marx, the notions of class systems. Certainly it's very easy to read the time machine itself as an allegory for a different kind of class system in the far future, where you have the Morlocks underground, you have the Eloi on the top part, and again you're arguing for what is the best way for society to develop. How can you develop a society? How can you actually use science fiction as a technique to comment on society, which actually gets people to think? That whole notion of sci-fi, science philosophy, comes to fore. I'll give you some examples there of some of the writers who are also around and writing at the time from that perspective. If you're looking at Time Machine, one of the sort of notions that possibly influenced it, written 6 years before Wells came up with this notion, was Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. But the time travel practically takes place because the chap actually sort of gets bumped on the head and you're left with that notion of maybe it was all a dream, maybe it was all a concept. Clearly, writing from the American perspective, Edgar Allan Poe was very much into the Gothic fiction and the notion of where things were coming from that perspective. But that's the other side of things. Archaeology is really developing as a science in itself. Realising that with Egypt, with Greece, with ancient civilizations, you know, civilizations had risen, civilizations had fallen. What caused that? How do we actually sort of recognise how we're working on today with our tablets, our devices, our screenshots and so on, that we'll still remain, you know, constant? Or will it all change? If the electricity dies, what's our backup? Well, worst case scenario, I'd use the sort of sheets of paper and work through that perspective. But it's all a way of how things develop within that whole field. And Wells certainly begins to address this. I mean, people often talk about Wells being a father of modern science fiction. They're right. But equally, when you're talking about what science fiction is, it wasn't known as science fiction in the early 1900s. It didn't really get that title until the mid-1920s, where it was kind of referred to as scientific romances. And that's the kind of line that, you know, in terms of how these things were being published, how they were being presented, how they were being serialized, that's how they became popular within the whole range of things. That's something which is less popular these days, although it still was a common theme at the time. The Hollow Earth scenario.
okay, humanity had not managed to successfully get to the North Pole or the South Pole. Shackleton's expeditions and so on were still, you know, some way ahead from that perspective. And certainly climbing Everest wasn't going to be accomplished until the middle of the 20th century. But there was still this sense that actually, you know, within not quite living memory, but America was quite a young country, been discovered a couple of hundred years beforehand. Why not an interior land? The sense of a hollow earth sort of aspect was developed. And that's certainly what Verne was addressing in the 1864 novel Journey to the Centre of the Earth. And the beauty about these kind of things is they're written, you know, in longhand novels, etc., the novellas. You could pretty much read through them in a couple of nights, basically. You know, they're not massive blockbuster texts, but they do have interesting themes to work on. There's a wonderful acronym in terms of this whole notion of hollow earths and also utopian fiction. Samuel Butler actually sort of coined this in 1872. He's actually just, if you reverse that, Air One, which is the land that's set in a term of utopia, you see effectively the definition of utopia, i.e. nowhere. It's a sort of line that's actually there within the whole sort of field. And again, less well-known Harbin's Land of the Changing Sun, also sort of illustrated. I've put all these slides up, actually, on the Blackboard site, so you don't have to worry too much about sort of back-end from that point of view in terms of if you want to access them and so on. And most of them are actually available for either 50p, 60p or less if you download them from Amazon onto your devices and so on. So we are, as we said, with Wells towards the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the dawn of the new century, fin de siècle, all of the things that come with that. And as I mentioned, Britain was very much at the top of its game. It was the leading world power. But we've already seen that there are other societies, other civilizations that had also risen to a peak and then somehow descended. And inevitably you come around to that line, which is a very constant sort of theme within science fiction, and will be again revisited later on this year with Independence Day 2, the next sort of follow-up from that point of view. What happens when a more advanced civilization comes in contact with a less civilization? As the colonies have developed, certainly with respect to British colonies and so on, usually it's not necessarily a good experience for the less advanced civilization. It can be that you're into that notion of one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. And maybe that whole notion, as some of the writers like Bellamy and Howells were actually addressing, all tied into the sense of how far and how long can we continue to go on this basis? And what would happen if, I mean, the opening line of War of the Worlds, no one would have believed that minds immeasurably superior to ours were watching this earth with a, you know, a sense of detachment that, you know, could be seen by the viewer in terms of a microscopic scenario. I'm paraphrasing the opening sequence from that point of view, but it is kind of raising that sense of foreboding. And actually, in many ways, obviously, with the notion of War of the Worlds, it kind of literally prefigured some of the atrocities and challenges that were faced within the two global conflicts that the 20th century was possibly going to be remembered for at that stage. The Boer War, of course, was still, again, emerging within that whole sort of sequence. The third of the kind of general constructs that you often see within this is you take a line in terms of the natural narrative tropes of strangeness. It's referred to as the Fremdunks effect, making strange. Darko Suvan would actually talk about the novum, the actual thing that makes something a novel thing. And the excerpt I actually just read out to start off with. The novelty is the word Martian. Everything else can kind of slot into a standard system, but that's what makes a kind of scientific romance stand out a little bit, whether it's time travel, whether it's a case of robots, whether it's aliens, whether it's strange worlds, whatever we're sort of working within that whole field. And Verne clearly was one of the major sort of folks who would actually talk about this. Again, writing in the 19th century about his view of Paris in the 20th century. you know, projecting ahead, something which had kind of not necessarily been part of a sequence, because one of the elements of civilizations is that you do get a chance to reflect not only on what has been, but also possibly what is to come. And it's no surprise that actually Wells, in 1935, actually directed and wrote the screenplay for H.G. Wells' Things to Come, which again talked about the future, sort of the notion in a town which was effectively every town. Again, the notion of fantasies, alternate dimensions. You know, what happens if you're living in an environment, as Abbott put forward, in Flatland, whereby dimensionally there is no third dimension. You know, there's no kind of, you know, there's literally just sort of length and breadth. You know, there's no width whatsoever as far as that's concerned. And also, as Forster actually alluded to when he wasn't talking about passages to India or various other aspects, the whole essence of what happens if it all falls to bits. What happens if the electricity stops, if the gas sort of stops, if the steam engine, the steam power sort of stops? It's no surprise that an awful lot of the steampunk culture kind of emerges with an awful lot of elements of Wells and elements writing within that whole system. Quelle catastrophe! We're all doomed. No, I've just got to the end of my first year of English. I can't be doomed. No, you continue from that sort of point of view. There is always this sense of doom and gloom, particularly at the turn of the century, but equally, you know, you probably remember 2012. We were all going to be doomed. No, we had the Olympics to go through. The turn of the millennium. I just think most of the folk actually in this room probably one of the last generation of people who would say, I was born in the 20th century. Coming up in the very few, in the very near future, people in your role of level one English students will be 21st century, born and bred. You know? But where do we actually head with respect to that whole thing? When she wasn't actually, I mean, there were two books that Mary Shelley actually did produce. Obviously, one, the most popular one and the most famous one is undoubtedly Frankenstein. But actually, in 1826, that's sort of 7 or 8 years after Frankenstein was published, she came up with The Last Man, which kind of has been varied in all sorts of ways, including sort of the Omega Man and so on. But again, this whole sense of working on previous mythologies, weaving those mythologies together, and developing that whole sort of sequence to develop this whole sense of, again, a Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods. Wagner was actually composing material on this basis, which obviously went on to influence Adolf Hitler, amongst others. That's unfairly. But that sense that somehow things were going to end and so on, and somehow we weren't in control, you know, the kind of equivalent notion of writing about climate change, climate disaster, catastrophic disaster, meteor impacts, all these kind of areas that kind of, you know, are really at the heart of an awful lot of speculative fiction, science fiction, scientific romance, and so on. And as I mentioned at the start, you know, clearly we were about to go into an era where two major themes were going to be seen politically and geopolitically: capitalism and communism, and the battles and challenges that worked through on that basis, that continuum. Arguably, both areas have their roots in what many folk have defined as Charles Darwin's evolutionary theories and the survival of the fittest. But actually, that's ultimately one of the areas that you're working through in both instances. Wells was particularly taking and actually argued that there should be a scientific elite who would actually rule and govern society for the benefit of all. Democracy is messy. You needed to actually look at a different sort of aspect, a different way to operate that. Again, remember also, heart here, slavery is fairly much in living memory. There'd just been a war in the United States in the 1860s, which was all about that, the whole issue. You've got a lot of upheaval, cultural change, adjustments that are taking place within that whole system. And inevitably, how do we cope with that? How do you actually move from what is primarily a rural, agrarian economy into a massive city cultures, where you see things develop within those whole fields. And all of these texts to varying degrees. I mean, Conrad, of course, also known for Heart of Darkness, have kind of addressed or looked at some of these sort of issues that have been working through around that sort of period, the end of Victorian governance or the demise of Queen Victoria into the Edwardian period. And just as in a sense, you know, we are currently still the second range of Elizabethans, which will move into a different sort of era in probably not too distant future and so on. Kipling, of course, writing there in 1912 before he was disillusioned by the First World War. And you can see, if you're ever interested in looking at the writings of Rudyard Kipling, a huge shift in his own sort of belief and patriotic beliefs prior to the First World War and what happened after the First World War when, of course, he lost his son. And the sort of lines that work within that whole system. And, of course, again, that whole notion in the interwar period, again, I moved that slightly on that basis, that Sinclair sort of would put forward in terms of the warning sequences and lines within that. Because, of course, the Russian Revolution, again, based on the writings of Marx, Engels, and so on, was also developed within that field. So we come to that whole essence of the scientific romance. The notion that if I actually did a survey of everybody who was actually in the room here, if there was time, if there isn't, I say, what does science fiction mean to yourself? And I guarantee you get everything from Star Wars, Star Trek, Doctor Who, robots, spaceships, starships, and so on and so forth. Yeah, it does have a very wide breadth. But it's kind of playing around with thought experiments. Nothing new in that. The ancient Greeks used to do it, and you could say that Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad were original sort of bases and tenets, you know, the fall of Troy, which kind of opened up that whole notion. But if we're looking at the period of time in terms of literature, and after all, we are an English degree, yeah, we'd probably look at that 60-year period, where as a general kind of working, saleable work of fiction, etc., that will be developed, the scientific romance in Britain would pretty much work along those particular periods. That's really at the height of when Wells, obviously, in the 1890s, kind of produced his work and went on to go on to consider various other factors. Possibly a bit controversial, because people might say, but he's fantasy, isn't he? Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Narnia and so on. C.S. Lewis also wrote various scientific romances as well, and also, if you look at some of his writing, it kind of developed that. Arguably, the very notion of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is a dimension shift. You actually access the other dimension through going through the wardrobe in the first instance and so on. And I mentioned some of the other sort of key areas and lines that work within that whole field as well. So let's go back to Wells from that sort of perspective, and let's particularly consider this whole essence of War of the Worlds, how it developed and so on. It was written in 1897, and by then he'd already, H.G. Wells, had written three definitive works of science fiction, as I'd mentioned. Definitive because actually they're still touchstones. They might well have been influenced by other writers of the time, as we mentioned. But if you actually look at The Time Machine, which, in the words of Arthur C. Clarke, merely entertains, although there's nothing necessarily sort of worrisome about the word merely, it does actually sort of open up a whole range of ideas and concepts. The Invisible Man, which is a classic case of science going wrong or being misused, or the mad scientist possibly. And The Island of Dr. Moreau, which again deals with genetic hybrids and the attempts to actually connect both animal and human DNA and structure, although DNA isn't referred to in that particular area. So what do we get within War of the Worlds? Well, as I said, one of the best tools you can ever have, and the one message I'd like to leave you all with today, if you get nothing out of this session whatsoever, is always ask yourself what's happening in the cultural context that it's being produced. Okay? Because that is a very useful detective system and a way of actually finding out a little bit more about what's likely to influence people. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's Margaret Atwood, whether it's H.G. Wells, whether it's Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, whomever, you know. Even Shakespeare, actually, from that point of view. I mean, it has been suggested that, actually, if you look at sort of Shakespeare's The Tempest, which was adapted as Forbidden Planet, you've got, again, another classic case of early proto-science fiction within the sort of notion of worlds beyond and so on. As we said, didn't get much better than this if you were British at that time. in certain instances, certain classes of society, you had an empire. A third of the world was pretty much under British occupation or rule. You know, the trading devices, the trading arms stretching into Africa, stretching into India, and so on, was certainly there, was a major player. America was still kind of coming out of its own civil war system. It was beginning to explore the notions of kind of global notion and so on. And the remaining kind of Habsburg empires, the Russian Empire and so on, they were significant but not major sort of issues from that perspective. And as I said, you clearly have this notion of colonies and colonists. The War of the Worlds actually is presented as a factual account of the arrival on Earth of metal cylinders fired from the planet Mars. The first cylinder crash lands on Horsell Common near the English town of Woking. It opens to reveal monstrous Martians, and one of the elements that you get from the text is a descriptive that consistently, unlike, I suppose, or possibly like contemporary equivalents, which base alien invasions as always landing on Washington or other sort of American-based cities. Here we have a situation whereby, you know, it's London that's being described. It's places like Barnes, Putney, Clapham, all of those sort of zones that are actually talked there. Because Wells, again, and the apocryphal tale goes that he was wandering with his brother across the countryside. So I wonder what it would be like if effectively this whole area was destroyed and devastated by some, you know, infestation or invasion and so on. It kind of began to sow the seeds for what became that whole notion of the Martian invasion and so on. And one of the key descriptors that comes through in the text is that for a long time it seems as though, because we don't have instantaneous Facebook time transmission and various other bits and pieces, it takes time, it takes 2 or 3 days before we realise anything is actually happening. You know, there's this whole sense that life is continuing as normal. Life will always continue as normal, but that strangeness is beginning to open up and so on. If you're actually familiar with the movie adaptations of War of the Worlds, again, both set in invasions in America, 1953 of War of the Worlds, it's California that's effectively sort of first place to actually sort of go down, and of course the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds, again, it's sort of a faithful adaptation of the text. In terms of other cross-media routines, Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds probably still remains the template in terms of staying pretty close to the original context. But there are also graphic narratives and other elements that we work through from that perspective. So what are the strange new lands that you get in War of the Worlds? Well, apart from the Martians, which we never really find, I mean, we kind of have the description of the Martians, multi-tentacled beings, effectively sort of literally just composing the tripod war machines and so on, the movement of that. You have that attempt with the red weed that's actually seen within the novel as part of the sort of offshoots of the Martian culture, something which is certainly reclaiming, changing the land accordingly. And of course the denouement, spoiler alert, the denouement that actually it's the microscopic organisms, the least significant of our own particular sort of experiences here, that prove to be fatal in the end to the Martians and effectively rescue the planet where in most cases, you know, we were doomed, and the general acknowledgement was things were, you know, beyond us. Again, that sense that ultimately there are still areas, there are, in the words of Shakespeare, more things that are dwelt that are in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our poor philosophy, Horatio, you know, from Hamlet. You know, that whole notion of where are these lands, how are they developing, and so on. And perhaps one of the most important tropes, again, to take away when you're thinking about any of the science fiction texts and so on, is this sense of the alien or the other. It's often being used to comment on our contemporary world. It's often used as a technique that sees science fiction as allegorical. It sees it as metaphorical. It sees it as a way of, as I say, commenting on issues by using something which is apparently fantastic to begin to really raise the question of what do we mean? What sort of key things actually do we mean and relate to the whole sort of sequence? Was, of course, the very famous radio play in 1938 where Orson Welles effectively adapted War of the Worlds and caused, by all accounts, mass panic in America because, again, it was delivered as happening as real. again, you're setting these sort of things in context and seeing that image of towering tripod war machines searing itself into popular imagination. It's very popular. We like the disaster movie. You know, this is one of the first kind of templates of a major disaster narrative where, you know, literally there are all sorts of problematic issues that are actually there. And as I said, historically, we come in peace, shoot to kill. Mars attacks and other sort of areas. First contact doesn't necessarily go too well. How do you relate to a different culture? How did the Native Americans relate to the European settlers? How did the Aztecs relate to the Spaniards? Etc., etc. How did the Africans relate to, you know, there's a kind of historical precedent here in terms of where things actually go and how things actually develop and how do you sort of address that. I mean, on a slightly tangential point, one of the reasons that Gene Roddenberry in the Star Trek series was so keen on the Prime Directive and the Non-Interference Directive was, again, looking to try and address this, to actually say that ultimately civilizations have the right to continue at their own pace, whether it's deemed to be appropriate or not. And clearly part of the reason for the major popularity of War of the Worlds and H.G. Wells in general was obviously through print culture and all the rest of its abuses, huge demand in America for this range of writing. We'd already cited people like Edgar Allan Poe, but I mean, from the European perspective, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells were very much looking to develop their own sort of writing and commitment to the whole system. It's often said that actually you've probably got two axes of science fiction, speculative fiction writing. One is American Western culture, the other one is kind of European, French, and British, more kind of melancholic sort of working. If you think of people like Aldous Huxley and Brave New World, George Orwell, 1984, you see kind of slight negativity in terms of that. Maybe it's because, you know, you were having to cope with that, having to cope with the change. Also, well, it's slightly beyond the remit of this particular piece, in the aftermath of both world wars, Britain had to kind of reinvent itself. You know, it has to, in all sorts of ways. So as we said, War of the Worlds was actually Wells' fourth novel. So in the context of the 50-odd ones that he was likely to produce in his own way, relatively sort of new in terms of his writing, again, very prolific writer. I think he was onto his second marriage or third or fourth affair at this particular time in his personal life, but we won't go too far down that line. But it did certainly look to work on putting in the science. So, as we mentioned, Charles Darwin, Voyage of the Species, or on the Origin of Species and the Voyage of the Beagle, two documenting scientific texts, but again critical to that whole notion of evolution. It's again difficult perhaps from our own perspective to appreciate what sometimes we pour scorn at, i.e. in certain parts of America, the notion that actually creationism is still, you know, the absolute undeniable ruler, that actually the world was created in 6 days, and that everything that's said in the Bible is literal truth. That was kind of seen as the default position. It wasn't until effectively through looking at the Galapagos Islands, through his own voyage of discovery, looking at the finches, looking at the giant turtles, looking at shifts forward, that Darwin gradually developed this theory, which combined and allied with the works of Hungarian monks such as Gregor Mendel, etc., kind of started putting together this whole notion of genetics after a fashion. I mean, clearly, humanity had been engaging in genetics ever since it took different horses, bred them together, and sort of developed new bloodlines and so on. But there was still this sense that, was it taking something away from humanity by actually sort of saying, well, ultimately, the human species is just that, another species, you know, interspersed into different races and so on. But maybe this whole question of natural selection, you know, what does it actually mean over periods of thousands and thousands of years? Natural selection you could see as being the microscopic universe, the microverse, Astronomers, slightly different, the macroverse. Percival Lowell, looking through his telescope and also confirming the works of Canali, etc., thought there are canals on Mars. There are definitely canals that are actually worked from that sort of basis. In fact, Percival Lowell actually speculated in 1895, the year of the time machine, and 2 years before War of the Worlds, that the planet Mars could once have supported life. Anybody who's seen The Martian recently will see maybe we're kind of coming full circle on that basis with respect to the line from that point of view. But nevertheless, you're doing here, and what Wells is doing is a classic line. He's basically taking ideas that are already in contemporary culture. They're actually deemed to actually have a scientific verisimilitude, a scientific truthfulness, and actually beginning to say, well, what would happen if? And really, that's at the heart of so much of the scientific sort of world. That actually, if you want to write science fiction today, I would say get hold of a copy of New Scientist, Scientific American, look at what things are actually sort of making progress, and actually sort of take it a bit further. You know, that's ultimately what you're doing. You're engaging in thought experiments and so on. And as we mentioned, War of the Worlds was very much presented as a factual account. We actually get the whole question and the line that how he actually sort of operates does relate to the notion of he's a married man. We don't see his name that's sort of coming through in terms of that. But it's still delivered from that whole perspective of the narrator and his opening sequence within that. I'll just sort of go back to that initial line. And again, it's become so much entailed and sort of in embedded in our particular culture. No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own. That as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurance of their empire over matter. It is possible that the infusoria under the microscope do the same. No one gave a thought to the older worlds of space as sources of human danger, or thought of them only to dismiss the idea of life upon them as impossible or improbable. It is curious to recall some of the mental habits of those departed days. At most, terrestrial men fancied there might be other men upon Mars, perhaps inferior to themselves, and ready to welcome a missionary enterprise. Yet across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. And early in the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. And that whole sense of the Great Disillusionment. Okay, we've got this vast industrial empire. We've got timetables that are essential because otherwise without timetables we can't actually have make use of a train. You know, we need to have trains leaving at certain times. We've got the great connectivity there, so transport infrastructures are in place. The canal system is actually at its height. We've also got the telegraph. That whole notion that almost instantaneously you can transmit messages across vast distances and so on, which is interesting enough why Arthur Conan Doyle, amongst others, was very much attracted to the notion of spiritualism. You know, the whole essence that, you know, if you can communicate with somebody who's in a different country, why not communicate with somebody who's passed over into a different dimension, possibly? And why not communicate with spirits from the grave, etc.? So again, you're working on those lovely tropes that sort of working through that, and again you're touching base on the sort of philosophy side of things. If you want characters and you want major kind of descriptions of those characters, then I'd say don't read H.G. Wells. At best you can say whether it's the soldier, whether it's the clergyman, whether it's his wife, whether it's the narrator himself, and I'm using the masculine, it is line from that point of view, you're not really getting an insight. The only thing we find out in The War of the Worlds about the narrator is that he is kind of a philosopher, after a fashion. He's a writer, he's a journalist, sort of, and that's it. And likewise his brother, who we kind of see as a sort of plot device within that. So you get the most basic descriptions of the characters. It's probably one of the reasons why so many adaptations have kind of opened them out and developed a whole range of other factors. But you have got ultimately this whole notion of it's an essential bleakness. There's a bleak tale that's actually there from that point of view. Possibly that's not selling it as best as it should be sold, but still. It is part of the genre that we probably refer to as invasion fiction. Okay? And again, you know, something which still proves to be popular and important even today. I thought I'd give you that as a little bit of stuff to actually just consider for a few seconds, etc. Because a couple of key points that come out of that particular statement, though, as a sort of statement, were that it was, as was the case with many writings of the time, which are later collated together and sold to us as books, novels, e-books, and so on and so forth, they were produced in magazines. Magazines were huge. They're still pretty big, to be honest. But, you know, they've shifted online, there are e-magazines and various other factors, but certainly Pearson's and Cosmopolitan, no relation to the Cosmo that you might be aware of today, were two of the major magazines at the time. And again, from that perspective, obviously it was a case of how the text and the narrative would be delivered. What do publishers of magazines want to do? Answer, make money. Ooh, yeah, they do actually. How do they do that? Well, one of the base techniques, if they're not giving free gifts and various other things away, is you actually run serials and serializations. So you actually see the ways in which the narrative development. You want to find out more. If you want a contemporary example of that, check out any of the works of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and the whole Marvel Comics empire. And DC Comics as well. And I still say, Superman vs. Batman is not as bad as people make out to be. So. In terms of that, if you want a really bad superhero movie, go to Fantastic Four by Josh Trank. That's terrible. But in terms of this whole sort of sequence, you have certainly got this whole area of where the thing actually appears, how it's evolving. It moved actually into a full book form fairly rapidly. As I say, it was only a year or so afterwards that they compiled it all together and developed the sort of line of something which was selling in its own field. And again, that serialization, that suspension, that's sort of working through that. Again, it's clearly divided, whether you get the e-book, whether you actually sort of get it's divided into two parts. Book one, which again outlines, as I've sort of alluded to, the normalcy, or the normalcy of society at the time, the coming of the Martians, how it begins to build that suspense, and then effectively the invasion happens, we're doomed, and then latterly Wells goes on to talk about the Earth under the Martians. Although the Earth and the description of that is primarily centred in that southeast corner, perhaps the London powerhouse that's actually sort of there, which is within that. Again, just summarising and beginning to draw some conclusions from that point of view, what you actually have seen there is either a commentary on evolutionary theory, which is clear from the point of view of Darwin and the impact from that perspective. Were the Martians, are the Martians more evolved than us? Maybe in some ways. Certainly they had interplanetary travel sussed, they had weapons sussed and so on. And yet, they didn't actually have any kind of defence against bacteria. Maybe it was a case that they were coming to it. Maybe it was, again, it was part of that whole notion. I mean, we haven't mentioned Lovecraft, who again developed a whole notion of Lovecraftian fiction, the Call of Cthulhu, and a whole range of other sort of areas, the strangeness. Maybe they were so strange that how would we relate to creatures that, you know, would remind us of being multi-tentacled octopi and so on? Would they be so strange we just wouldn't be able to appreciate them? But also, again, that whole notion of British imperialism. Apart from Thunderchild, which manages to take out two of the Martian war machines, and I think one of the earlier segments of the book, in the early period where Shell manages to actually sort of knock off a war machine. It was hopeless. You know, the pride of the British Army, completely hopeless against Martians and the invasion war machines. Bit like bows and arrows going up against well-drilled units and artillery gunners and shells and so on. And again, a time machine sort of notion. About 90 years ago, they were actually testing the British tanks here. We were used in World War I and so on. Actually, 100 years ago. I'm saying 100 years ago. The other three things that popped in there are important, because Victorian society, as I'm sure you sort of as we headed into the Edwardian period, was also very hypocritical. It tied in and opened up superstitions, ties up a whole range of fears, prejudices. It's no surprise that Bram Stoker's Dracula, also written the same sort of time, was so successful, because Stoker's Dracula deals with what Edward Said terms as the other and the unknown, and Orientalism in particular. And that whole sense of Orientalism as being something that we're afraid of, because what are these foreign people who can't even speak the Queen's English actually doing, coming over here and actually sort of taking our jobs and taking part in cities and so on, and clearly other areas, you're getting Jack the Ripper, it stalks, all sorts of other things kind of mix up in terms of that, which allow you to prejudge, to develop things, and to wonder what is happening, what is working through that. And maybe from an entertainment point of view, the War of the Worlds works because it effectively takes humanity to the brink of despair and destruction, and even kind of in the role of the soldier, puts forward the notion of somebody who's effectively, in his own words, it's the thinking as well as the doing that is just too exhausting. Do you actually get a situation whereby all is lost and then there is a kind of final resolution that actually sort of, if not victory, at least sort of raises the sort of point of, well, phew, that's okay then. Did it happen? Sort of final concluding sort of area is something which, again, is one of the reasons why 120 years or thereabouts after it was written, we're still actually giving academic lectures and talking about what Wells has actually been doing in terms of this. And I put the sort of the hyperlink on this, but I actually talk about where, even if you've never read the book, War of the Worlds carries with it a certain cachet, a certain sort of scenario that you sort of know kind of what it's referring to. And again, I've popped in a sort of hyperlink there to something which illustrates some of the sort of key areas that we've got there. Is it prophetic fiction? Well, War of the Worlds, World War I, World War II, World War III. War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. I'll say it again. I mean, again, war is unfortunately one of the sort of aspects that does tie in very much with technological progress, if only because it's the person who's got the biggest guns, or the country that has the biggest guns or weapons, that usually succeeds. Hence, of course, the atomic sort of age that emerged with Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and so on. So did it predict that kind of area? Well, kind of, maybe. As I say, we haven't, as far as we've been aware, been invaded by the Martians. Although, again, it's culture, it's interesting. If you take some of the 1950s paranoic literature of the Americans' invasion of the body snatchers and so on, you have another fear of the enemy within, again, that being communism and so on. But it certainly does kind of allude to that. It presents a series where, or what Wells does is, in talking about the War of the Worlds, or the War of the Countries, it's kind of also presaging the fact that maybe we're not going to have tremendous success all the time. Maybe we will lose battles. Maybe there will be issues to work within that. Is it influential? Does it kind of relate from that? Well, I think I've probably kind of, without going too much into rhetoric, hopefully sort of developed those kind of things, because yes, I would say it is highly influential. Which is one of the reasons why even now you still get that relationship to Hollywood and the lines within that. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the end of proto-science fiction. Can you make sure you've signed the register, which has been circulated around, hopefully, from that point of view? and I shall see you anon, hopefully.